I'm Liz Hirschnoff-Tolley, and welcome to the Capital Coffee Connection. And I'm looking forward to our conversation today. We have the mayor of Miami, Francis Suarez, who is going to talk about what it means to be a mayor and really about the heart and the humanity of the role he plays. We don't talk about politics and policy. And really, the goal of this podcast is just to get to know our elected leaders for who they are. And one of the things that I love about mayors is that mayors are nonpartisan. They really are there to serve all the people and to make their communities stronger and to listen to what the needs are of the people that are living in their cities. And just as a funny piece, you know, the people that I actually checked, I've never met this mayor, but I did ask around, and most of the people I talked to are Democrats and the mayor is a Republican. And what they kept saying to me is, this mayor is amazing. We love our mayor. So I just think that that's a beautiful statement, and it really kind of zones in on why we're here. And one of the things that you had said in one of your interviews, Mayor Suarez, and then I'd love to start talking to you, is you said, we spend 80% of our time focusing on the 20% of things we disagree on, instead of the 80% of the time focusing on the 80% of the things we do agree on. And I thought that that was just a great way to say that we really have so much more in common than what separates us. And sometimes we get bogged down in like what we don't agree on, but there's so much more that we share in common. So in that, I want to say welcome and thank you for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. What a beautiful introduction. What an honor it is to be with you. And I think you've got to the essence of, in very, very short period of time, of who I try to be, who I want to be, and who I strive to become on a daily basis, right? And you hit on something that I think is so fundamental and yet so lost in the conversation, which is our shared humanity. If you were to, any given weekend, go to a family event, you know, watching a game, or, you know, people watching the Super Bowl. I'm thinking right now of the Super Bowl party that I was at. You know, you are gathered around an event that everybody can relate to, right? This football game, this sort of social gathering. And people are having great conversations about life and family and love, et cetera. And you don't know what people's political affiliation is oftentimes. You don't really care, to be honest with you. It's not particularly important. It's not fundamental. And yet in the political world, in this, I would call it the new political world, frankly, it becomes an obsession. Right. And when you have political conversations where, well, by the way, it's really funny because, and I suppose NFL and, you know, professional coaches go through this, but as someone who does politics for a living, right, in my professional capacity, I cannot tell you the number of times that I'm at a dinner table and a political conversation occurs and I'm the last one that they seek advice from or input. It's like everybody in the table is an expert. And this guy over there who happens to do it for a living, you know, maybe he'll chime in. Maybe he won't chime in. I'm not so sure that we particularly care what he has to say. And it's funny because if it were a doctor or, you know, some other profession, they're considered to be experts, right? I mean, and
right.
Never think of having a conversation at a dinner table that a doctor is sitting at a medical conversation without consulting or including the doctor or thinking that you know more than the doctor, right? And yet in political conversations, that's what happens. So it's just an interesting moment in politics. It's a little bit frightening, to be honest, because I think that people like myself are not well equipped for this. And I was talking about sharing this morning with somebody I was talking to on the phone with. You know, if you are someone who believes that you need to communicate ethically, morally, that there are lines that you should not cross, like attacking people's families or even getting personal, frankly,
right.
There's really no reason to get personal. Right. I mean, you can disagree with people without being disagreeable. You can vehemently disagree. You can have very, very different points of view, debate them vigorously, intensely, and still shake the person's hand and actually like the person. Say, hey, look, I like this person. They may come from a different way of life, a different background. We're all shaped by our life experiences. And I think that's another thing that's lost in this conversation. We're getting these. We're right, they're wrong, or this is how I feel, and therefore that's the right perspective. And we lose the fact that every single human being, every single one on the planet, every single one is different. Oh, we've had different experiences. You know, we grew up in different places. We've had different traumas in our life, right? These are all things that shape us. They shape who we are. And there's an equal sign, and it's us, right? Like me as an individual. And I feel like we don't spend enough time focusing on the other side of the equal sign. What are all these things, the pluses, the additions, the exponents, you know, the divisions that make us, that equal us, right? What is the story of us? And I always, when I do my podcast, one of the things I often ask people is, you know, what's your story? I want to hear people's story, because I don't think you can know someone unless you know their story.
Yeah, no, it's exactly true. And, you know, the human genome says that actually all people on, going back to all people on Earth, we're 99.6% the same DNA-wise. The only thing that separates is 0.4%. And for me, this podcast is like, what is that 0.4% so that we can learn to understand each other, but not to use that against, but use that for, because as we come together, especially when we're a little bit different, we actually do better as we come together.
Yeah. And if I could express that mathematics in a completely different way, I would say this. You know, even now, maybe genetically, we're 99.6, like you said, a percent similar genetic. But I would say socially, we're 99.6% different, right? Because everyone has had a different social upbringing. Everyone.
Right.
Some people go to Catholic school. Some people go to public school. Some people have parents that have been married their whole life. Some people have parents that have been in 3 or 4 or 5 marriages. You know, some people have traveled the world. Some people have lived in the same place their whole life. Some people have gone to 5 different schools. Some people went to the same school from kindergarten all the way through high school. Some people have had, you know, one girlfriend their whole life who became their wife. And you know, some people have, you know, have done it differently. So, you know, in some cultures, there are multiple wives, right? That's part of the culture, right? So it's just terrible for us to assume that we can sort of paint things with a broad brush. And I'll tell you, in my travels around the world, the one thing I've learned, if I've learned anything, it's that people want a lot of the same basic things. They want a prosperity for themselves and their children. They want their tomorrows to be better than their yesterdays. And they want to live in peace and in harmony.
Absolutely. Right? Amen.
Like,
yes.
That's it. Like,
I agree.
That's it.
I agree.
There's nothing more than that. And, you know, you can get into the nitty gritty and the details and obviously wealth and accumulation of wealth and how does that impact your life? Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. But that's really the basics. And I think that's cross-cultural. That really does not depend on a culture.
No. So talking about that, you know, about background. So your family is Cuban-American and you have a great relationship with your parents. And could you talk a little bit about like what it meant to be raised by immigrant family and what it means to you to be a Cuban-American? I think your experience and what you went through, plenty of people can relate and then many don't understand it. So it's a good opportunity for them to not only understand what it means, but what it was like for you growing up.
You know, my parents came to this country at 12 and 7. My father was the 9th of 14 kids. My father, I would consider to be an IQ genius. And I would consider my mother to be an EQ genius. My mother walks into a room and when she leaves, everyone feels better about themselves for her presence. Right. And, you know, it's just a totally different background, totally different upbringing, the two of them. My dad, like I said, was an intellectual giant, got high school scholarships, got a presidential scholarship to go to the university, graduated summa. 2 graduate degrees from Harvard. He's written 9 or 10 books on a range of topics from astronomy to religion to political philosophy to economics. I mean, he's written on just about everything. So he's just an amazing guy to be around. And he's definitely the most well-read person I know. So it's fascinating. We are traumatized by our birth story, if you will, which is that my parents were kicked out of their country, right? Their country was taken over by a guy who was charismatic leader and who said, give us all your property, give us all your businesses, and we'll make everybody equal. And he did. He made everybody equally poor and everybody equally miserable, you know? And people now risk their lives to come to this country, leaving and fleeing, you know, the country of my parents' birth, which is Cuba. So we're shaped by that, you know, and I'm blessed. I'm the oldest of 4. I have 3 younger sisters. I live a very, very sort of strange opposite Brady Bunch life. I'm 46. My parents have been married for 48 years. I've been married for 17. All my sisters have been married and are on their first marriage. They all have kids. I have kids. I have two kids. My wife is also the oldest of four. Her parents have been married for 46 years. You know, we've been married for 17, and all her siblings' first marriage, all with kids. So it's what maybe it would be like a 1950s lifestyle. But I'll tell you that if anyone were to ask me, what's the secret to your success? I would say my faith, my family, and my friends, right? And sort of in that order, right? My faith is my connection to God. So that's my spirituality. That's like my, what helps shape my inner being, right? My connection to the inner, to the Almighty, my purpose. So that gives me a lot of, you know, a lot of desire to live and accomplish things. I would say in connection with His will for me. That's the way I would phrase it. Then my family, I mean, I just articulated my family. I'm very blessed. I'm uniquely blessed, I think, in the modern day that I have this family. And then in my friends, I have a lot of the same friends that I had since I was 2 years old. I've been very blessed. I can count on probably one hand the number of friends I've lost in my lifetime. True friends, like real friends, right? Because politics is a different thing, right?
Yes.
There's political friends and there's real friends. And I pride myself on having people by my side that I love, that I trust, and they love me for who I am, not because I'm the mayor or because I was a councilman or whatever I may accomplish in life. It's not about that for them. It's they know who I am, the essence of me. You know, I was born and raised in Miami. I'm the first mayor of Miami that was actually born in the city. I went to high school in the city. I went to college in the general metropolitan area. And then I went to law school in Gainesville and University of Florida. You know, I was not the overachiever. I was probably an underachiever for the vast part of my life, maybe because I was my father's son who was such an overachiever, you know?
Right.
It was sort of maybe a rebellion. But at some point in my life, I'd say I'm about 20, I decided that I had to sort of turn it on, you know, and that I had to, if I wanted to do something significant with my life, I had to get serious. And I started getting serious and disciplined. And then I could see the byproduct of that. So I was definitely a late bloomer, which I think is a nice thing to share with the audience, because, you know, there's some, I think, misperceptions that anyone who's successful must have been like this super intense go-getter, super involved. They knew what they were going to be at 10 years old, you know, and I am quite the contrary to that.
Right.
I was a person.
Well, my mom used to always tell us, you do not want to peak when you're 18, you know, because like we'd be in high school and I'd be looking at all these others and they seem like their lives were just more enchanting and more incredible. And she'd be like, you just do not want to peak at 18 because, and then she would tell me stories about like her reunion and like the kids that peaked at 18 when they were, you know, 40 years later, they weren't doing so well. But I think our goal is to keep trying to peak, trying to get to that place. Could you tell me a little bit like your parents sound like amazing people. Did they have advice for you growing up, you and your sisters, like some saying they would have or something they would say to you, which came from obviously their experience, but that they wanted to give to you as a young person in a new country?
So I'm smiling because I'm thinking really more of my grandparents. I'm thinking of my grandmother on my mom's side, and I'm thinking of my grandfather on my dad's side, my dad's dad, and my mom's, these are the two things, the two nuggets that stay with me from their generation.
Yeah, that's important.
One of them is my grandmother used to say, in life, I'm going to say it in Spanish, and then I'm going to translate it. She would say, en la vida uno siempre tiene que ser agradecido. In life, you always have to be grateful. And I think that gratitude, thanking God every day for the things that you have, as opposed to thanking, you know, obsessing over the things that you may not have that you want, I think that makes all the difference in your perspective, in your attitude, in your approach to life. And you know, I'll tell you, the biggest compliment that you can give me was the one that you started the show off with. You know, not because it's Republican Democrat, but because I think what I got out of it, the compliment, was that I've had a positive impact on these people who you spoke with, and that their impression of me is, this guy's a great, you know, he's alive, he's fun, he's jovial, and I'm trying to transmit that and connect with people. And so I feel like I did my job. And so that the inner me became connected to them. So I think that's one. The other one is, he kind of marital advice, right? And this came from my grandfather, who said, when your wife tells you to jump off a roof, you start looking for a low roof, you know?
Okay.
That's helped me survive 17 years of marriage. But in terms of my parents, I would say this. I grew up very different from my wife. My wife grew up kind of sheltered. She lived in a suburb of Miami called Coral Gables, which is a very sort of a wealthy area. And, you know, we're very different in that sense. I grew up, I was a nomad. Think Mad Max. I was the guy riding on the things where, you know, I was a nomad. I had no curfew. So the biggest thing that my parents did for me was the example that they set of a loving couple, of good parents, of responsible people, of ethical people, right? Yeah. I remember a story. My dad was mayor. My dad was also the mayor. I kind of glossed over that. He was a mayor from 1985 to 93. And I remember a story very vividly, which shapes me, which, you know, the city had a contract with us, with the cable companies. And one day I get home, and this was in the 1980s, when you used to have the little brown boxes, the cable boxes. I don't know if you remember that. We had all these channels, you know, like HBO and Showtime, and, you know, all these things back then. It was like, oh my God, the movie channels. So I remember my dad gets home that day, and I was so excited. And I said, Dad, we've got all the channels. We've got HBO. We've got Showtime. And my dad's face changed, like from, you know, normal to like anger, you know?
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And what I realized was that the cable company had given us those channels. We had not. That wasn't part of the subscription, right? Mm-hmm. And so my dad, you know, was upset. He was furious. And he said, no, you know, I do not want anything from the cable company that I have not paid for. And he called the cable company and they said, you know, Mr. Mayor, you know, everybody, you know, we're doing this for all the elected officials, you know, it's gratitude. You know, we're grateful. We have this contract with the city. And he said, absolutely not. He goes, but nobody has rejected.
For your dad.
Yeah. And he said, I don't care who's accepted it or rejected it. I'm paying for basic cable. I want basic cable. And I do not want anything from you that is above and beyond that. And I think nobody was watching. Nobody knew about it. It wasn't a press
thing. He knew it wasn't
a press thing. He didn't make a press. He didn't call a press conference the next day and say, you know, the cable, you know, I'm such a good guy. Nobody ever knew about it. In fact,
I mean, he didn't tweet it. He didn't put it on Instagram. He didn't want it. Yeah. Like where we are today. Yes.
None of that. And nobody known about it. Had I not witnessed it, I wouldn't have even known about it. He may have been the only person in the world that would have known. And the world would never know the story.
But from his example, you learned.
Absolutely. And I learned that your integrity matters and that it matters even when nobody's watching. You know what I mean? And so, you know, that's something that always stuck with me. Your name matters. Your reputation matters. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's I've always tried to live that way. And, you know, you always try the best you can.
It's a good story. It exemplifies good parenting and I appreciate that you shared that with us.
When you asked a question,
yeah,
it's not that there was like a saying or a motto. It was really their life in a way that was an example. And so I always tell my wife that, you know, I do believe that it is important to express yourself, not just be the example. And I've learned this as a boss. I've been, you know, running the city for 7 years and I was a councilman and in both those jobs, you're a boss, right? And I do think it's important to not just live the example, but to be clear as to what the expectations are. And I think if you don't do that, you risk someone not getting the point that, hey, I'm trying to live this way. Not everyone gets the message. And as a boss, I think you have an obligation to be clear with people.
And look, it goes back to the basic expression of actions speak louder than words. So we want to show that. And going from that to being a parent, first, I know that you have a wife who, I don't know, maybe some consider your better half. From what I understand, she's quite a dynamic woman. But she also is very supportive of you being a public figure and what your demands are of being a mayor. And could you talk a little bit about how that works so that people, because you said you've been married for 17 years, and that's pretty special, and your parents have been married a long time. So what is that secret ingredient of not just going back to the 50s, but that respect and that ability to have her support you. And I hope and I believe you support her. And I know that you help with the kids. I know you drive them to school. So I know that you're doing what you can to be an active parent.
You're well informed.
Well, let me tell you something. Any father that I read drives his kids to school. I think it's worth mentioning. It's because I know that you're not doing it, so I mention it. Again, it's about the actions. It's because that's important to you to do.
So I'll say this, and I think at the risk of sounding hokey pokey with what I want to say, I'm going to say it anyways because it's the truth.
Okay.
My wife is the most precious gift that God has ever given me. You know, she's someone that I really look up to and admire because she's innately good. It comes easy for her. It's a lot of work for me. it's easy for her. And I just really admire her, who she is at her core. I've also seen her evolve. So it's not like she's been this stagnant person. And her evolution has been very beautiful, seeing her evolve. I mean, we met, I was 29 when I got married. She was 27, I think. So, I mean, I've gotten to see her develop and grow as a woman and as a human being. And it's been beautiful to watch. I can honestly say I'm more attracted to her today than I was when I met her, which is very unusual. I mean, it's hard to imagine. She's in her mid-40s and she looks better than she did when she was in her late 20s, which is, you know, incredible. And it's a testament to her and her discipline and how she takes care of herself. And I think it's also a testament to the love that she has for me, you know, in terms of, you know, wanting to, you know, us to maintain this connection, right? This physical connection as well as an emotional connection and spiritual connection. I think spirituality is a big part of it. I know it's going to sound again cheesy, but, you know, learning people's love language, we're very different. I love words of affirmation, you know, like when you said what you said at the beginning, that certainly that gives me, like, that sort of fills my spiritual gas tank, you know, that gives me energy, like, wow, people think this, I'm doing the right thing. I thought I keep doing this. My wife is more of an acts of service. If I want to show her that I love her, I do something to help her, right? I take the kids to school, you know, help them get ready in the morning. You know, I help her clean up, you know, after we have guests, or help her set up, right? Like, these are things that I honestly hate to do. I absolutely hate it. I grew up in a very patriarchal family, sort of old school Cuban. The dad works. When he comes home, nobody bothers him. You know, he pays the bills. So he has earned the right to be left alone, essentially. That was kind of the hierarchical way that things were back then. And that's not the way it is now. And so I have to embrace that. And it took me time. It really did. It took me time to, and I'm still working on it. I would never venture to say that I have it solved, but I definitely do think about my grandfather's saying about, you know, finding a low roof, right? So I've learned, and I almost feel like I turned the corner like a year ago in terms of really focusing on three or four core things. If I were to give marriage advice, if I was back then, I guess it was Dr. Ruth who used to give marriage advice. I don't know. Maybe I'm dating myself, but if I were to ever give marriage advice, I would say this: focus on the three or four core things that you know are going to move the needle with your significant, and try to get better at those specific things. I know in my case, it's being more patient, like, you know, with my wife. Obviously, acts of service, like I said. Number three, it's, you know, when we get into an argument, you want to call it a debate, a discussion, I see it as like, you have your point and I have my point. That's not the way she sees it. She sees it as, I want to tell you my point and I want you to validate my point, right? And I have a hard time with that because for me, I just get her perspective. I'm like, okay, your perspective is great. You have her entitled to your perspective. Now let me give you my perspective, right? Yeah. She doesn't want to hear my perspective. It's not about me. Like, her view is, it's not about you. I'm expressing to you how I feel. Absorb it. If you can, validate it. And that's it. Like, move on.
Okay, I just want to just tell you what you have just said is a key to so many what women are looking for. And the fact that she has trained you, explained it to you, and you're working on it, it says a lot about you and it says a lot about her. Because it is a process. But I think that is what you've just said is so important. And I appreciate your honesty and your authenticity, because it's not easy for men to express that.
It took me 17 years. I mean, literally, like I told you, I think I turned the corner a year ago. And I think, and again, this is going to be an admission against my own interest. It really, you have to turn on the listening part. And listening is hard, because how well do we actually listen? You know, particularly we're getting in a debate or an argument. You're really listening to the person only insofar as you're trying to figure out what your counter argument's going to be, right?
Like, exactly.
You're listening.
Right.
Okay. But this, but that, right? To actually listen is really hard. It's really hard. And I think It's a skill that I've tried to get better at. I actually think, interestingly, when you're going through rough times, sometimes it's easier because what happens is, and this is, I would say this about my wife, because I could go on about my wife for a podcast just on her. But I would say, you know, my life, and hopefully everybody else's at some level, has been like a lightning, right?
Yeah.
So there's been a great times for an extended period of time, and then a downtime, which just feels terrible and awful and, you know, hopeless. And then you sort of turn that corner and you go back that way. And I think after 17 years, having been through a few of these, you know, and having seen her in those moments where I've been a couple months where I told her, listen, if you want to get off the train, I get it. Nobody likes this, you know, and it's awful. And you're getting dragged through things that have nothing to do with you, that you don't deserve, frankly. And if you want to get off the bus, it wouldn't bother me. You know what I mean? Like, right. In the sense that I understand. And she's like, are you crazy? Like, I know in my heart that no matter what happens, she's always going to be there for me. And that creates a sense of loyalty in me to her that makes me say, like, hey, if I'm not loyal to this person, what kind of person am I? You know what I mean?
Right.
So,
yeah. No, she sounds very special. And I look forward to meeting her one day. Having as a question for people that, you know, people who are across the country, I'd just like for you to take a moment just to say, and only a moment, because you could probably do another podcast, but what is special about Miami, Florida? What are like a few things that are just special that when people are listening, they'll understand what makes your city unique and why you're passionate about the work you do?
I'll start with one word, attitude, right? We have an attitude where we embrace the greatness of this country and everything that made this country what it is. And I think a part of that is the fact that we were kicked out of, a lot of us were kicked out of our own country, right?
Right.
And so we have a deep sense of appreciation, and we found so much generational success in one generation, where we know that if you just stick together as a family, you work hard, you play by the rules, you know, you treat people kindly and with respect, you have a very good chance of being successful in this country and passing along that success to the next generation. So I think that's really the secret sauce. You know, again, there's a lot that goes into that. I think a lot of American cities right now, and I love my brother and sister mayors, and I don't mean this as a direct criticism of them as individuals, but they have gotten a little lost in that. You know, they've, and we're benefiting, frankly. You know, we grew 14% last year. We had the lowest unemployment in America. We had the highest wage growth. We had a lower homicide rate last year in 2023 than we had in 1947 when we started recording homicides. In 1947, we had a third of the population. In 1980, we had 220 homicides. Last year, we had 31, right? An 85% reduction from that high. So what we're doing is dynamic, is special. It values, in my opinion, you and everyone's most precious asset, which is not how much Bitcoin they have in their bank account. It's their time. Right. And I think once cities start building themselves around what I call ROT, return on time, if cities don't do that, they're going to fall behind. The cities that do that are going to get
ahead. Right.
You can call it quality of life. Some people call it quality of life. Right. I call it return.
Yeah. So the last fun part is I'm just going to ask you a few questions about you. And it could be a one word answer, it could be longer, but just a handful of questions for people to just go, oh, that's interesting about the mayor. What is your favorite sound?
The water crashing, the waves crashing in the water, I think.
I like that one. What is your favorite color?
Black, believe it or not.
Okay.
The absence of color, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is your favorite smell?
My favorite smell is cologne. Good cologne.
Yeah. One of my questions, which I'm not going to put you on the pressure, but I've asked others, is what's your favorite housekeeping chore? But since I already heard you don't really like housekeeping or cleaning, I think it'll just be when you have a party and you can support your wife to clean.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I think anything that I do that makes my wife happy is my favorite chore.
And do you exercise? Do you have time to exercise? What do you do?
I do a combination of things, but first of all, I cold plunge. I've been cold plunging almost every single day since I started the year.
Right.
Then I work out, and then I have like a little steam room in my master shower. So I do that for about, depending on the how much heat I can take, 5 to 7 minutes. So sometimes I do HIIT stuff. Sometimes I do CrossFit. Sometimes I just do weightlifting. It depends on the day. It depends on my body, how much rest I got. how I feel. I work out with my wife, so that's a lot of fun too.
Good, good. And what would be the one meal if you were stranded on a desert island that you could have? What would it be?
Oof, if I was stranded on a desert island, it'd probably be fish. You know, I'm a big spear fisherman. I love spear fishing, so I probably would go for catfish and eat the fish.
And where in the world would you and Gloria would love to go with your kids as a trip on a trip that you've never been before?
We're going soon for the first time to Europe. We've never done that before, so that's gonna be a lot of fun. Look, I think the way I look at traveling is I don't know how to describe this, but it's, you got to hit the basics first. Like as with kids, it's like they got to take them to Rome, they got to take them to Paris. My family's from Spain, so we go to Spain, right? So take them there, and then you get more exotic. You know, and then I do want to do some stuff, which I actually have never done, like in the continental U.S., right? And go to like for example, the Grand Canyon. I've never been to the Grand Canyon.
It's a great place to take your kids too.
You know what I mean? I've never done that. So, you know, the redwoods, trees in California, I'd love to do that with them at some point. So there's the Niagara Falls, you know, there's stuff that I want to do that I've never done myself. I certainly would want to do it with them. My dad's never... You know, he's a 9 to 14 kids. He's never been like, you know, he's not an extravagant guy, which is a good thing. And so we've never like packed in a Winnebago and like, you know, gone stuff. I kind of want to do that one day, like drive a big Winnebago and have my kids, you know, and do some family stuff like that, like road trips, you know?
Okay. I'd like to get a photo of you driving the Winnebago. Okay.
You got it. It's
okay. Yours. What is your favorite music?
80s. 80s genre. Probably my number one favorite.
And the last one, which is, and you may have already touched on it, but just as an interesting one, what is your superpower? I mean, I think everybody has a superpower or two, but what is yours in personally, not politically, but just personally?
I think a lot of people would say my energy. You know, I think a lot of people, that's one I hear a lot from people. Wow, you have so much energy, like really good energy. I think that's part of it. I think I try to be very nice to people. And I think sometimes people mistake niceness for weakness. And that's always a delicate balance in politics is how do you project, how can you be nice to people and treat people nicely without them thinking they can take advantage of you? And that's just really tough. It's a tough thing to balance. And every once in a while, you have to show a side of you that people say, well, maybe I don't want to mess with this guy. You know what I mean? That's an unfortunate reality in politics and leadership. It's not just politics. I think in any leadership dynamic, it's a tough thing to balance. I wish I could be nice all the time, 100% of the time. But unfortunately, sometimes, you know, you're called upon. You know, there's a great movie. I'm a big movie guy and I love movie lines and movie scenes. There's a great scene, I'll end with this, from the movie Roadhouse, first one with Patrick Swayze. And he says there's three rules. And, you know, the first one is take it outside. The second one is never underestimate your opponent. And the third one is be nice. Be nice until it's time to not be nice.
Well said. Okay, we're on our last question, which I've asked a lot of electeds, and I love my answers. And it's about joy, which you've talked about, especially even going back to your grandfather and his advice. But what does joy mean to you? What gives you joy, and how do you share that joy with others?
It's actually a very profound question, in my opinion. And I would say this, I'm not a naturally joyful person. You may be surprised to hear that. My dad is a super joyful, almost to like, I don't know if you ever read the book on Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson, where he talks about Steve Jobs' kind of ability to bend reality to his will. That's sort of the way my dad is. He's joyful in a way that almost seems like divorced from reality. My mom is very emotional, and this is where the EQ thing comes in, and can trend to kind of sadness or a little bit of like a, you know, pessimistic personality. I've just learned over time that doesn't really work for me. You know, it doesn't. So for me, joy is the goal. I think it starts with, personally for me, it starts with my faith. If you're restless internally, it's hard to get to that place of joy. You need to be internally comfortable, internally settled to get there. And I actually think there's a lot of things that have to do with physiological dynamics too. You know, I think you've got it, you know, the three basics, eating, sleeping, and exercising. I think those contribute tremendously to whether you're joyful, whether you're energetic, or whether you're melancholy. And there's a lot of science to that, right? In terms of your dopamine restoration when you sleep, your release endorphins and serotonin and dopamine when you exercise, and just eating and giving yourself the the fuel, right, to be joyful. So I think about that, you know, and then I think, it goes back to the word that I think describes our city and is attitude. You know, is this glass half full or is this glass half empty? I mean, that's your attitude. That's your perspective.
Right.
You can get up in the morning and you can say, oh, I don't have this. I don't have that. There's all these things that I want that I don't have. Or you can wake up and say, you know, God, I'm so appreciative and grateful for waking up, for having energy, for the wife, my kids, my jobs, my public service, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I've just learned over time to be joyful and to look at the glass half full.
Thank you for taking this time to share your heart, your humanity, your home, your hope. And it has been a great joy to meet you. And I look forward to one day meeting you in person. But for today, I just want to say thank you for sharing yourself and really blessing us with your presence. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for this opportunity. I mean, what I love about the new podcast world is everything is free-flowing and, you know, long form. And I think that, you know, we've for a long time in our society, we lived in a short form world where everything was in sound bites and 2-minute
yes.
increments. You just can't really get to the essence of anything. I think that's why content is so being so disrupted right now. And people have so many different outlets to get information. I mean, I don't even really watch TV. The last thing I saw last night, I couldn't put down this podcast that I was watching last night. I have this other podcast that I'm watching this morning. It's free. You know what I mean? And I'm watching it and it's just like, so that's where people are getting their information now, particularly, I think, thoughtful people.
Yeah. Well, it's a very democratizing way to get information because everybody has access to it. So on that, have a beautiful day in Miami and we'll see you soon.
You have a beautiful day as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, it's Liz. Please join me every Tuesday for coffee to talk about heart and humanity with our elected leaders. Ciao.